Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to week 49. Well, I know because she says it, that's how I know. This week, I actually think we have a shot, not a realistic one, but a shot at finishing chapter 14, which has been going for quite a while already. It's 13, 14 as a unit. I'm not going to go through the review again of 13 and 14 like we did last time, or the time before, whenever that was. But we are in the trial of Yehonatan. And we know he's on trial because we think he's on trial, we'll see, because he ate from the honey that was out in the field during the battle, unaware that Shaul had sworn an oath that no one should eat that day. When Shaul asked the Urim Bitumim whether they should pursue the war against the Plishtim, he did not get a response. He believes that it is because someone has done something wrong. And so he sets up an investigation of sorts in which he says, I'm going to stand here with my son Yehonatan. Everybody else is going to be on the other side. And we'll see where the guilt lies. And then whichever side is guilty, then we'll drill down and find whoever it is who's in the wrong. And sure enough, Shaul and Yehonatan are the ones who are snared in this. We discussed very briefly what exactly the mechanics of this were, but they are the ones who are identified as the guilty parties. And Shaul declares Havat Tamim, right? That was in Perek Yedalet Pasuk Memal, chapter 14, sentence 41. He says, Havat Tamim, tell me who is... Well, he didn't say that. He says, Havat Tamim, give me something that is complete, that is perfect, or potentially innocent, we'll see. And Yehonatan is the one who is identified. So, here... Correct. Only the brief note that I gave last time. So Yonatan's response here is not to justify what he did. He doesn't say, I didn't know about it. He doesn't say, as he said when he first found out, that oath was really the wrong move. No excuses, no nothing. And Malvin says, this is because Yonatan is tzaddik. Yonatan is righteous. He says, you know what, if God says I'm guilty, I'm guilty. That's all there is to it. And he's willing even to accept his own death. I should note, there is an alternative way to read Pasuk Mem Gimel, sentence 43, although none of the classic commentators read it that way. But you could theoretically read it as Yonatan saying, Ta'om ta'amti b'kzeh ma'ateh asher b'yadi ma'at devash, I tasted with the edge of my staff a little bit of honey. Hineni amut? Shall I die for this? Mm-hmm. But that's not the way the commentators read it. They read it as a statement.
No,
sorry.
Question marks in the.
It would make much more sense. Like it's more plausible as a character. I like the nice. He's a nice, perfect guy, but this is a real person.
Understood.
In the cantillations, is there any way of indicating a question?
There are ways that you could, but nothing here.
Not here.
There's nothing here. No.
Just thinking.
So thinking is good. So Shaul says that Yonatan, in fact, shall die. Mm-hmm. And what we started on last time was the two tracks that you can see within Shaul's verdict. Track number one is, this is justice. He's guilty. We have this oath, Chayrim, as we saw from Ramban, it carries a death penalty. He's in the wrong. And that's one way to understand the verdict. Ralbag says, we learn the importance of an impartial judge here. The fact that Shaul is not going to show favor to him. We discussed a little bit of the back and forth, Ralbag and so on, but that's the basic... that's the basic approach. Then you have the other approach, which says, no, that it's beyond justice. That really, as a letter of the law thing, he should not be killed. He didn't even know. It's shogig. It's an accident. However, Shaul wants to demonstrate that the oversights of Eli and Shmuel, where their children got away with things, are over. I'm not going to let him get away with that. And Ralbag added, it seems that what Ralbag was saying was that Yonatan's harsh reaction when he found out about the oath was problematic in and of itself. It set him up in opposition to Shaul when he said, my father took this oath, that was terrible. And that he should have recognized that victory is from Hashem. So the nation responds by saying, don't kill him. And we're going to see the same two tracks in the nation's response. Meaning, one track is going to be to say, he is guilty, but he shouldn't die. And the other track is going to be to say, no, he's actually innocent, don't do this. Ricky.
I have a problem with somebody, a human, making an oath which would result in somebody's death. I have a problem with that. That is almost lo tirzach. Maybe in terms of judgment, maybe if somebody killed a lot of people, I can see judgment. But just an oath such as that, it has nothing to do with justice. It has its reasons. I understand the logistic reasons. But at the same time, this is a man who's saying, okay, if somebody does it, he's going to be killed. I mean, what's the difference between that and lo tirzach?
Well, you're presenting it as an oath. I would present it as a law. In other words, it's not a matter of...
I have the same problem with law.
It's not a matter of the statement of making everybody swear. That's only the authority that's behind the law. But fundamentally, when you are a king, you set up the rules by which the nation operates. And what we're learning here is the king has the ability to make a law with a death penalty as a response to failure to follow the law. What we saw from Ramban is that the authority resides in the king and the authority resides in the Sanhedrin, the high court. They can establish a law with a death penalty for violation. And that's what Shaul did. You may not like the fact that there's a death penalty involved. You may say, well, what did he, after all, do wrong? Even if he knew about it and he really is that on the level of murder. But the answer is it's not about that. It's about the authority of the throne.
But what about the fact that it wasn't necessarily publicized to everybody properly?
What?
Like, how do you deal with the fact that there's a law and, like, okay, it's in effect right now, and if you happen to hear it, you're good.
But how did the messenger get there?
Right, so,
right?
Again,
you don't have any...
Everybody else knows. It's just Yonatan, who happens to be the one who eats, who does not know, but because he wasn't there, correct. But what you're already discussing is a step down from it. In other words, Roberta's question is the implementation issue. Ricky was asking about the whole conceptual idea. But the concept is, this is the scary part of having a king. Kings are able to do stuff like this.
Did
any government, but...
did he actually say that anybody who does this will die?
Wait, so that was Ramban's point. It's built into royal decrees like this.
Right. So basically anything the king says, if you disobey...
If he declares it on the level of Kherim, it's, yes, it carries a death penalty. That's correct. And that's something we're going to see more of. Get used to it. The idea that the king's authority is absolute and that it can carry a death penalty for a violation, this ain't the only time we're going to see this.
Isn't there a higher authority that puts a limit on that?
No, the higher authority empowers the king.
Higher than a king.
No, that's what I'm saying. The higher authority empowers the king. It's God who's empowering the king.
God is the only one.
And the only thing that reins in the king, so to speak, is that he has to follow God's command. That's where Shaul gets in trouble. Right? When he either doesn't bring, you know, doesn't wait for Shmuel for the Karban, doesn't manage the war with Amalek the way he's supposed to, that's when he, in fact, gets into trouble for not following that authority. But here, he hasn't, it seems, violated any divine order.
But this law does not come from up above. Do you think that God...
By definition, the king is empowered by God, and therefore the king's decree is a divine decree. That's the idea. That's how this works.
Like, in other words, God set up the system.
Yeah.
How about, is there any writing in the commentary that sort of goes into that, or is just a physical?
Well, that's the whole idea of monarchy. If you go back to, if you really want to see where this, you know, where this is phrased, look in Devarim chapter 17, which is where the king's authority is first presented, and then look at Shmuel, Perikhet, when Shmuel gives the nation the list of the things that a king can do, and we had a debate. Was Shmuel intimidating them by telling them things kings are not supposed to do, but they're going to do anyway? Or was he actually telling them, no, here are all the things kings can do. You should know what it is that you're accepting upon yourself. But either way, the nation has been duly warned. They know exactly what they're getting into.
I think what we're witnessing is the consequences. Where Hashem is saying, are you sure you want a king? Like, do you really want a king? Like, there's a warning about that. And what comes to mind for me is the sacrifice with Abraham and Isaac, because you have the sacrifice and he can bring it back. He can intervene and bring back his decree, like change his mind. Or, well, I shouldn't say change his mind. We don't know if that was the intention always, but he's not sacrificed. But here you have what it is for a king as opposed to God.
Well, a king can also rescind. He just has to rescind it before the violation of the law, right? In other words, had Shaul issued an order saying no eating, but then an hour or two into the battle said, you know, that didn't make any sense, and retracted,
right,
that would have been that.
Right.
The problem is that he didn't do it before and vice versa. If Abraham kills Yitzchak, and then Hashem says, you know what, I changed my mind,
right,
it's too late.
Done. Right.
Correct. Diane?
No, I was thinking of Abraham. God tells Abraham, kill your son. He says, oh, forget it.
Yeah.
And we have many examples of God showing compassion towards us. Moshe goes and pleads to God, don't kill them all because of the eagle. Okay, I'll save them. Put it in a little here. Couldn't Shaul have had that same compassion towards one of his subjects as well as his
To which the answer is, had it been any subject other than Yonatan,
for sure.
For sure. But it's not. His son went out and crashed the royal, you know, chariot into the public feast or whatever it is. You know, it's from the perspective of the book as a whole, looking at what happened in the beginning of the book, looking at Hophni and Pinchas, looking at the sons of Shmuel, and knowing what's going to come next, knowing what's going to happen with the sons of David. Right? This actually makes, you know, I hate to say it because I feel for Yonatan, but this makes a lot of sense for Shaul to say, I'm going to hold the line, and it's my son, but I still have to hold the line. But let's see what, let's see more. Yeah, Rambam has its place.
Not only did he eat it, but he also criticized it.
Right. Although, again, Ralbag notes it, but no one else in this trial, you know, brings that to the fore. Let's look at how this is dealt with. Pasuk Mem Hei. Sentence 45, 1445. Vayomer ha'am el Shaul. The nation says to Shaul, Hayonasan yamus asher asah Yeshua gedolah azos b'Yisrael? Shall Yonatan die? He did this great victory. Right? We know that on two levels. Right? He was the one who routed the Plishtim in the first place, and then he also led them in this mop-up campaign. Chalila chai Hashem mipo misaras rosho arza. God forbid he should not have a hair on his head fall to the ground. Because he acted for God on this day, and the nation redeemed Yonatan, and he did not die. How many different arguments do you see in their sentence?
Two.
What are they?
One is he did so many good things.
Well, he engaged in this great Yeshua. That's number one. What else?
He acted for God's sake.
Well, im Elokim asa, we don't really know what that means. He acted with God on this day. So it's not really clear what they are saying when they say he acted with God. Two approaches. A first approach, again, is he's guilty, but he shouldn't die because he acted with God. Radak takes it the way that Diane said. If you take a look at source number one on your sheet, im Elokim asa. Klomar, tova asa im Elokim ve'im amo. He did well, or he did something good. He did something good with God and with his nation. The ki higdil bitchono be'Elokim umasar nafsho al am Hashem. He demonstrated great faith in God by the fact that he went ahead with this, and he also elevated his faith in God. He also gave his life for the nation of God. Going with his armor bearer to fight in the Philistine camp. In other words, as Radak reads it, it's all one point. He performed this great salvation as part of demonstrating his willingness to act on behalf of God. That doesn't change the fact that he ate the honey, right? He's guilty, but he still shouldn't die. Abarbanel reads it a little more practically. He says, She'im Elokim asa hayom hazeh, with God he acted on this day. He wrote to Lomar, Shelo ayu ma'asav b'chet u'be'avon. Excuse me. His deeds were not sinful. His eating was with God, and in fact, was a function of God's oversight. He shouldn't die. Meaning, if Yonasan ate, it was because God wanted him to eat. Because he didn't have light in his eyes, right? Meaning he was weak. Ukdesha yischazek b'milchama, and so that he would be strengthened in the battle. Ratza hakel yisbarach ba'achilasa. Hashem wanted him to eat. It was good that he ate. Va'asu bazem mofez raya shaloa yachote, and they said, "We'll prove to you it's not sinful." Ki ima yachote lo haya kadosh baruch hu oset shua biyado. Had he sinned, God would not have given him the victory. Much like with Yonasan, we said if it had been sinful for him to do the nichush, then God would not have assisted him. So what Abarbanel is arguing here is a practical point. If he ate, it was from God to give him the strength to create this victory.
But that, you had the victory before.
Yeah.
Before you.
Right. No, all you had before was the initial route. Then you have the follow up where it's at first he killed 20 Plishtim and he got them going, but now you have this successive battle where he leads everybody and they chase out the Plishtim and they're willing now they want to go even further. The Plishtim?
No, the other Jewish people.
The other people are starving, correct. Yonatan is credited with leading this.
The better they all should have eaten.
Correct. That was Yonatan's point. That was what Yonatan said.
It was a silly
rule. That was Yonatan's point. But the silly rule or not, the law is the law. So the version of this in Radak is he's guilty, but he shouldn't die because he showed great faith. The version of it in Abarbanel is that he's guilty, but he shouldn't die because God gave him his stamp. Ricky.
I don't know whether you use the word sin. When you don't follow law, it's a crime. But is it a sin?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, no, it is. This is an important point because Shaul is God's chosen one, right? Think of the phrase, divine right of kings, right? Any act against the king's order is an act against God. There were other hands I saw on this side, but I don't remember whose.
Didn't we have some bad kings, though, with some very bad laws?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
we didn't follow them. Was that okay?
So Diane asked the classic question. In the modern IDF, we have something called Pekuda Ichukit Baalil. I'm getting the words wrong a little bit. But essentially, it is an order that is clearly illegal. And you have this in any army. The concept that an order can in fact be an order that should not be followed, right? Counter the German thing, right? About only following orders. We have the idea that some orders are illegal. But this is not illegal. You may think that this is counterproductive, but there's nothing immoral about an order that says don't eat. Nor was that a function of what he did. He just didn't know. It wasn't I know and I don't care. It was ignorance. Yes.
I think also that the fact that the statement he said over and I means that they don't put everything there for us, it's significant that he was really disappointed when he was almost, I don't know, so weak that he was over and up to see.
Right.
So that justifies in
Well, it only justifies pikuach nefesh if you know that there's a law that you're breaking.
Right.
You know, he didn't even know. It wasn't like he made a calculation of, I shouldn't eat, but I have to.
Yeah.
He thought it was okay.
Yes.
He had no idea. So that's one school of thought. He's guilty, but he shouldn't die, whether because it was lishma, he's doing everything for God, or whether it was because, look, God gave him his stamp of approval. The other school of thought is that what the people are saying here is he is innocent. Targum Yonatan, in source number 3, I brought it as cited in Radak. I didn't actually look in the original Targum Yonatan to find it, to double check. Radak's pretty credible. Arei kadam Hashem gali, di bishalu aved yomadein. Before God, it is revealed that he acted in error on this day. What the people were saying when they said, Im ha'elokim asa, right? He acted with God. The Targum Yonatan says what that means is God knows that it was an accident. And therefore, he's not guilty. That also fits with the fact that they said, Chai Hashem, right? By God. Meaning, what they're saying is God knows that he shouldn't die. You're saying God is the source of authority of the law. My response is God knows that actually he didn't break the law. Now, this is a little weak. As Radak points out, it's weak because they also have this line about Asaha Yeshua HaGadolah HaZos B'Yisrael, that he performed this great victory. If all you wanted to say was it was an accident, you didn't need to mention all of that. So that's it's a hard response to read. Yeah, Sam.
Imagine if, okay?
Yeah.
Imagine if he knew the law, okay? But he realized, I've got to finish this battle, so I'm going to eat this, it's going to just give me that little spark, and I'm committing myself to die anyway so that I can win for the people.
Oh boy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then what?
Then he dies, no?
Yeah, but I'm saying...
No, man, this is a what-if.
I'm just saying, because everybody else didn't eat it.
Right.
They were also weak, not as weak.
It's an interesting scenario, but it's I have no idea what to do with it. Yeah.
I don't know.
It's not what's going on here. I mean, here it's fairly clear. The text says it explicitly. He didn't know.
He didn't know.
Yeah. But look at the end of the sentence. Vayifdu ha'ames yonasan velomes. They redeemed him. The word redeemed is an odd word. Redemption normally, right? Pidyon haben, pidyon shvuyim, is you pay something in order to get someone out of a situation. Right? Ufduye Hashem Yeshuvun. I mean, there are all sorts of different uses of this term that will come to mind. So, right, so there actually is discussion about what that means there. It's not so clear that that's not the same thing. Also, that there's a payment and a redemption. I think Malvim has a comment on that.
Yeah,
on Pidyon in that context. I don't remember what it is, but I remember seeing a comment from him on what that means. But three different ways to look at this. First way is Ralbag. Ralbag says, don't worry about it. It means they saved him. Don't get hung up. But if you look at number four, V'sivavu Yisrael shalom es Yonasan. Israel caused him not to die. Ki im Elokim asam asab bayomahu, because he acted with God on that day. Bine hatzlacha azos nikres pidiya. It means they were successful in saving him. Though Ralbag says don't get hung up on this word. However, we will promptly ignore Ralbag. Because there are two ways that the commentators take this term, that they were podehim, and they fit the same two tracks. The first approach will be that they redeemed him by arguing that he's guilty but he shouldn't die. And then the second approach will be they redeemed him by arguing that he was innocent. As you'll see. Radak quoted the Targum with the first approach in number 5. He says, Matam asher asaha Yeshua, lo haya ela mipnei shehaya shogeg. What do you mean when you say he performed the salvation? What does that mean? He's pointing out the Targum Yonatan approach, and that the people were saying that he did all this by mistake. And because he was by mistake, therefore yes, it's true that he's guilty. Radak doesn't actually take the accident part of it, just that it was a mistake. It was a mistake, and therefore don't hold him liable. Stronger, the Radak. I'm rethinking the way I take the Radak. I'm going to jump to the Medrash Shmuel in number 6 because I think the way I read Radak may not necessarily be the only way to read him. But take a look at the Medrash Shmuel in number 6. Rabbi Elazar Amar Nasnu Mishkalo Zahav Uftauhu. They redeemed him literally. They made a donation. They donated his weight in gold, and that was how they redeemed him. It's a financial redemption, just like Podesh sounds like. In other words, So, right, so we don't know to whom. Who got this?
The war effort.
The honey fund. I don't know.
the king's coffers. Wasn't that corruption?
It does sound like corruption.
I actually think it's brilliant leadership because as opposed to the king forgiving his son, he has the people buy-in. It's actually, it shows tremendous leadership.
Yep.
Unlike the fathers before.
Mm-hmm. He gets the nation, and it helps that in this case, his son hasn't hurt the nation. In the cases of the fathers before, the crimes were against the nation. But the Medrash reads it as, he's guilty, but nonetheless, we're going to buy his freedom. The nation says, we want to buy his freedom. Malbim, take a look at number 7, reads it this way. Gam im chata, even if he sinned. Halahu asa Yeshua gedolah, he performed this great victory, this redemption, salvation. V'ha'am yimseru nafsham alav kimo shemasar nafsho alehem. We are going to give of our lives, just like he gave his life on our behalf. He put himself on the line for us. So their redemption of him was a statement of, you have to go through us in order to get to him. He endangered himself for us. We have to give ourselves for him, and therefore he should be exonerated. And then the last take within this is Malbim's second piece here, which is also brought in Rashi. The nation redeemed Yonatan. You see that? They got Shaul to repeal his vow. He had a way to do it. Well, in order to do Hataras Nedarim, in order to repeal a vow, what has to happen is the person has to say, yes, I took this vow, but had I known at the time what I know now, I never would have done it. I regret it because now I'm smarter than I was then. So, for example, a person takes a vow. They say they're not going to shower for a week. 2 days later, they're walking around the street and no one wants to have a conversation with them. No one wants to talk to them. I say, you know what? Had I realized what the impact was going to be, I never would have taken this vow. So they go in front of a Beis Din and they have to explain what they did and why they regret it. And the Beis Din says, okay, your vow is repealed.
Yom
Kippur does not work for this purpose. Vayelo Pesach Charata, he had room to do that. Aydesha Amru Ha'am, Yonatan Yamus, the nation said, should Yonatan really die? Meaning, the vow was a bad idea because it carries a death penalty, and had I realized what that would mean, the implications of a death penalty, I never would have taken such a vow in the first place. That's the approach that says he's guilty, but he shouldn't die. Either he shouldn't die because look what he did for us, right? Or he shouldn't die because do ataras nedarim, repeal the vow, you can do that. Or because we're willing to make a payment on his behalf, but ultimately he shouldn't die. And that's one approach. The other approach, again, is the argument that no, he shouldn't die because he is innocent, and that's part of the pidyon. Take a look at number 8, which is also in the Medrash Shmuel, which says, look at what he did. Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, V'chi lechem achal. He didn't eat bread, right? Remember, I noted for you when we read it that lechem doesn't really mean bread, it means food. But he's a literalist. He says, look, he didn't eat bread. He just had honey. He didn't have bread. The defense attorney steps in. Reish Lakish Amar. Vichy Achal. Reish Lakish says, did he even eat anything? He had a little taste. That was it. Veina tuna bracha. It wouldn't even require a bracha. He's referring to the halacha, which is somewhat debated, about someone who's cooking and then they just taste the food, but they don't even swallow anything. And whether you make a bracha on it, he says, come on. He didn't break your oath.
Is that what
the kezayit refers to? No, kezayit is for the bracha achrona. So the bracha afterwards.
No, but I mean, if you eat less than a kezayit, you can make a bracha?
Bracha before, yes. It's only bracha achrona, not, yeah.
But he does admit Yonatan that he ate. I mean, that's how it sounds.
Yes, Yonatan says I'm guilty, but the nation says not so fast, as read in this medrash. And then you have a barbanel. And Abarbanel has a radically different way to read the whole story. Bless you. And someone anticipated this last week. I think it was Leona who anticipated this last week. this is to say that, in fact, Yonatan really is innocent. Take a look at source number 9. Nilkad Yonasan. Yonasan was trapped. He was caught, whatever that means, in this mechanism of the lottery. Lefisha huya ish tzadik v'tamim haya bedrachav. That's my underline. He was righteous and complete in his ways. Meaning, when Shaul said hava tamim, don't read it as give us a perfect lottery. Read it as show us who is innocent. Yonatan was identified not as the guilty party, but as the innocent party. Lodia, shelo nedra tshuvata urim ba'avon ha'achila kmo shaya choshev Shaul. The reason that Urim Batum didn't answer when Shaul asked, should we pursue the war, was not because Yonatan ate, which is what Shaul thought. Ki'a Yonatan ha'ochel v'aya shogeg. Yonatan ate accidentally. He didn't know. He ate on purpose, but he broke the law by accident. Abal haya v'chatas Shaul atzmo. It was Shaul's sin, not the eating. And the people said, not guilty. Why would you kill him? He's innocent. We're going to see more about this. We're not done yet with this comment of Abarbanel. I'm going to come back to it. But the idea is that God himself, yeah, that's the way to read Havatamim, according to what Abarbanel says. Abarbanel has two approaches, right? One approach was what we saw already earlier in number 2, that he argued that if God gave him success, that's a sign that he must have been innocent, such as because he was ignorant. But Abarbanel number 2 here says that actually Yonatan was legitimately innocent. So we have two tracks all along, right? One track says Yonatan is guilty, and that's why Shaul wants him killed. And the nation says, yes, but. Yeah, he's guilty, nonetheless. The other track is to say that he's not guilty, but Shaul feels a need to go above and beyond, and the nation, in their response, say, no, don't do that. That's a terrible idea. Terrible idea on top of terrible idea. Don't do that.
Well, if he's not guilty, why does Yonatan say, yes, I did it. I'm guilty.
And the answer may be because he also isn't aware.
He thought he was.
You know, he thinks he's... It's a good question. You know, Barbanel is playing this out as though the whole issue wasn't guilt at all. Wasn't Yonatan at all. The issue is something else entirely. But Yonatan clearly believes that that's what's going on.
Both Yonatan and Shaul.
Yeah.
Because of that conversation.
Yeah. So the big question you have to ask, though... Right, the big question you have to ask here is, if you take the innocent track... Right? If you take the track that says that this was all beyond justice, Shaul felt the need to take a stand, right? And you take the view that he acted with God means he was actually innocent, it was a mistake, it was whatever, right? And if you take the view that them redeeming him was in fact an argument that he really was innocent, that he should not be held responsible. Then the big question is, why didn't the Urim Batumim answer Shaul? If no sin took place, then why, when he asked, should we pursue the war, did God not say, go for it? We took that as a sign that there was something wrong. But if he's innocent, then what was the how are we supposed to understand this the Urim Batumim's silence? So, three different approaches. Approach number 1 is Rav Sadia Gaon. Approach number 2 is the Malbim, and they are exact opposites. And then we'll see Abarbanel, whose approach stems from what we've already seen Abarbanel say. Rav Sadia Gaon says the following. It's brought in Radak at number 10. Piresh HaGaon Rav Sadia Zal. Ba'avur hera'os la'am ki shogeg haya. The point was to show the nation that Yonatan did it by accident. That was why the Urim Batumim didn't answer. Meaning, ki ayu omrim maso panim yesh b'davar ki ben ha'melech avara l'cherim v'lo ne'enash. Otherwise, people who know he ate but don't know that he didn't know about the oath would think, why is he getting away with this? Must be because you know what happens. There's protexia, right? That's what people are going to assume.
That's what Shaul was afraid of.
Exactly. They'd say if anybody else had done this, they would have been punished. Not everybody knows that Yonatan was absent during the oath. But now that Shaul isn't answered, they had to go looking. So who is wrong? Who's in the wrong? It fell to Yonatan. And they investigated and they found, Yonatan wasn't around at the time of the oath. So that way they all learned this. And then they said, oh, he shouldn't die because he wasn't there for the Shavua, for the oath. So the way Rasaji Gaon reads it is, this was necessary in order to identify him as innocent. So that everybody would understand, yes, he ate, but no, he's not liable.
So according to Rasaji Gaon, is this the first time Shaul heard about it as well?
Yeah.
It does fit into the...
it would appear.
Yeah.
So it would appear, although I think it doesn't have to be so. It doesn't have to be so, but yeah. Malbim says just the opposite. He says it was to indict Yonatan. He says, Vayikar, number 11, Shashem chashav letzadik hazesh ardavka bo ha-hashgacha ha-shogig kizadon. Hashem is dealing with somebody who is so righteous that Hashem is willing to look out for him, right? When he does this whole attack on the Plishtim in the first place, Hashem makes him successful, the whole business, give me a sign, and if they say this, and if they say that, right? This person who is on such a level that he's so close to God, even an accidental sin is like an intentional one. And then he adds a point. After he heard that he had violated this chayrim, what he should have done was gone to his father, told him what he did, and say, please do ataras nidarim, right? Repeal the vow. Befrat, and now there are two ways, right? But then get him to repeal the vow. It's retroactive. But then befrat, there are two ways you could read the next clause. I'm reading it the way I think is correct. Befrat ki amar achar avias haaretz, especially when instead, what was his reaction? My dad ruined everything. Ubeneder kazeh shelo hoil bazel amilchama azos yachol yischarev charata demeikara. He could have easily gotten his father to be able to take the vow with a vow like this, which didn't help in the battle. Right, it's bad for them in the battle. It's another reason to do ataras nedarim. So he could have done it. And in fact, when the lottery fell on him, so Shaul did Hataras Nedarim. But the point of this is indeed, Yonatan is guilty. Yonatan is guilty, even if it was an accident. Nonetheless, Yonatan, with the person you are, with the status that you have in the in the Jewish people, you are responsible even when you sin by accident. Not that there's something else that you could do differently. It's not saying because you're so great you shouldn't have made this mistake. But because you're so great, even if it was an accident, you're still going to be punished for it. And then again, it leads to Hataras Nedarim. It leads to him, to Shaul repealing the vow. For the reasons we mentioned. Yes, Linda.
Does it never occur to anybody that maybe it was Shaul who made the sin because he made the oath?
So that's where no one says that he sins by making the oath. We are going to see it turned around and say that it's his sin. But there's no sin in a king making a law, even a bad law. It may be a mistake, it may be a bad idea, but it's not a sin. Yeah,
is why the Urim and Tumim couldn't answer, because indeed there had been a sin committed, but whereas it's Yonatan's sin, and maybe it isn't Yonatan's sin.
Right. So we're coming back to whether it's Yonatan's sin or not. We'll see that in Abarbanel. But in Malbim's read, the other way to read Malbim is that it's not criticizing Yonatan for his response to his father, but it's showing, with the way he said it, that this was a bad idea for a vow. Well, then why didn't you say that to your father? And get him to do Ataras Nedarim. It's a bad idea for a vow. You could have said that instead of blurting it out to the nation. You could have gone back to your father and said, this vow that I just heard about is a terrible idea. Yeah.
Isn't the worst punishment for a person to have something of this brought upon your child?
Yes.
So maybe that's what that's all about then. But is a way for Shaul to realize the error of his neder through the potential loss of his child.
Yeah.
Now he's going to learn from that, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. So you're saying do this whole thing in order to teach Shaul a lesson about vows and laws. It's interesting.
Because the vow put everybody in danger, potentially.
Yes.
Going to battle hungry.
Right. I hear you. I hear you. I had not thought about it that way. It's an interesting idea.
Also, I think those Hatarat Nedarim, he can't do it retroactively, can he? I mean,
no, you do. That's what Hatarat Nedarim is. It is retroactive.
It is retroactive?
Yes.
If somebody else...
had eaten, they would not be liable. That's correct. So that's the classic question, which we discussed when we did Shoftim, but it's a lot of years ago that we did that story. But that's a major discussion. Why didn't Yiftach, remember Yiftach was the one who took the vow about, you know, whoever comes out of my house is going to be a carbon, and it ends up being his daughter. So we had a lot of discussion at the time about why Yiftach does not do Hataras Nedarim, and one answer was that he was ignorant. The Yiftach is not presented to us as this paragon of Torah greatness. In Yiftach's day, things are pretty bad. Go back to Shoftim. That was one answer. Another answer that was offered was that in the Medrash that there was actually a point of pride between him and Pinchas, and Pinchas has come to me, and all that. Another idea was that actually Yiftach was being punished by not being able to remember Hataras Nedarim. He was being punished for a separate wrong that he committed. Like, there's a lot going on in that story and that dynamic. But they asked the question about why no Hataras Nedarim. So what we see here are some of our two ideas about why the Urim Bitumim did not answer Shaul in the first place if Yonatan was innocent. Right? The first approach was to say, because this way everybody will find out he's innocent. Second approach is to say no, that on his level he in fact is guilty, even though he's not guilty, even though really it was an accident and so on, nonetheless, he's going to be held responsible. And then the third approach is what we started saying before from Abarbanel. Take a look at number 12. He says, V'ani achshov, you know what I think? Shalonana Shaul Beurim Bitumim Lo Bechatas Yonasan Kiim Bechatas Atzmo. Shaul wasn't answered with the Urim Bitumim, not because of Yonasan's mistake, because of his own. Allah Sharavaris Bi Hashem Begilgal, Kemoshin Iskar, for not waiting for Shmuel for the Karban. Ulufisha Chua Zos Lonasan Akadosh Baruch Hu Al Yado Kiim Al Yad Yonasan Uzchuso, since the victory over the Plishtim did not come about because of Shaul, it came about because of Yonatan. Right, his move that he made against the Plishtim and his merit. Therefore, when Shaul says, "Should we go after the Plishtim?" Hashem doesn't answer. To say, "I'm not interested in you, Shaul. You blew it. You brought the carbon when you were supposed to wait for Shmuel. So when you said Havatamim." You know, show us who's innocent, right? Which, again, there are two ways to translate Havatamim. Either give me a perfect lot or show me who is innocent. It fell on Yonatan because he was innocent. That's the way that Abarbanel reads it, completely changing the story.
The fact is that Shaul actually was told that he's not king anymore.
Yeah.
King of God.
Well, he wasn't told he's not king anymore. He was told that his descendants won't be. He is king, yes. Okay.
I'm curious, yeah. If this wasn't Yonatan who broke this rule and it was just some ordinary person,
yeah,
how the people would have reacted, but the fact that A, he's Shaul's son, and B, he just did this whole, yeah, he was
right.
A hero, you know.
Well, look at their wording. How do you think they would have responded to with somebody for whom they could not say he acted with God on this day?
Right.
Right. It sounds like they'd be dead.
Is it problematic for Abarbanel that Hashem now does answer with the Urim and Thummim, or that's different because of the guilt and innocence situation?
So I think well, let's wait until we see that. We're about to see it. We have to see what comes next. Okay. So that's our trial of Yonatan. Yonatan is spared to have more adventures later on. Let's take a look at the end of this parak. Vayal Shaul Me'acharei Plishtim, Pasuk Memvav. Vayal Shaul Me'acharei Plishtim. So Shaul says, we're not going to war against the Plishtim. We're not going to war. U'Plishtim Halchu L'Mekomam. And the Plishtim went home. V'sha'ul achar ha'meluchal Yisrael v'yilachem saviv b'chol oivav b'moav u'v'nei Amon u'v'edom u'v'malchei tzova u'v'aplishtim u'v'chol asher yifnei yarshia. Shaul fights against all of his enemies. We're sort of going around the map here, right? You have Moab, Ammon, Edom, east and south, Machet Sova. I'm not sure where Machet Sova are. They say here Aram Sova, so that's actually going to be northeast. It's going to be northeast. So we're not going quite around the map. Uva Plishtim, the Plishtim, of course, are west, southwest. Uvachol Asher Yifne Yarshia. That's a very interesting turn of phrase that we're going to have to spend some time on. Let's see. Roberta, you have an art scroll. What do they translate of Uvachol Asher Yifne Yarshia?
Wherever he turned, he inspired terror.
Wherever he turned, he inspired terror. That's a very interesting read. Francine, in the pink edition, what do you have?
I have, and he would cause them to tremble.
He would cause them to tremble. Same idea.
I just have mischief. Which doesn't sound
he caused
bad.
Wherever he turned, he caused mischief. Mischief is not the word for these wars. That's a fun read. Eileen, what do you have there?
I didn't think it was so bad.
But is that mischief in the modern sense?
I can't think it is. The end of 47.
Yeah. But then wherever he turns himself, he puts
them to the worst.
He put them to the worst. Wherever he turned, he put them to the worst. Meaning he harms them.
Oh.
Yeah. Like Russia, I mean, is all, where all of this is coming from. Nanette, is your edition different, or is that
no.
the same one?
No.
Okay.
How come Plishtim is included as well if you're not supposed to like
them? Oh, that's nothing. Take a look at the next sentence. Vayas Chayil. He acted with force. Chayil, again, has a lot of different meanings, but here it seems fairly clear that it's military. Vayach es Amalek. He struck Amalek. Vayatzelis Yisrael miyad shoseyo, and he saved Israel from those who raided them. So that's really interesting, because Amalek is coming up in the next parak. So we're going to have to see what's going on with this. But we have two questions now. Number one, what is this business of wherever he turns Yarshia? Mischief, terror, like what exactly is that about? Before that, though, in Pasuk Mem Vav, what makes Shaul back away from the Plishtim? Why didn't Shaul pursue the war?
How does the other Urim become?
The Urim and Thummim didn't say anything.
Well, that's
no, it didn't say a thing.
What did it say by Ya'al mean then?
Sorry, by Ya'al means he ascended. He went up away
but
from them.
He didn't say yes.
Away from them.
Presumably.
And he got no answer. Yeah, it
didn't say anything.
May operate. Didn't say that. Sorry?
Didn't say yes.
Didn't say no.
Yeah, so isn't that...
And it doesn't tell us
yes.
And also, if he's doing all this, it means he has an assembled military force. So why would he ask Chayil?
So he's doing Chayil, just not against the Plishtim. Right? Oh, you mean there, right. It mentions
so
Plishtim now. So
then why would he then have to Ya'as Chayil to go after Amalek? And that was, is it a different force? Like it seems redundant.
Okay, so let's pause here. I was going to go through the last psukim also, but let's... No, that's all right. There's enough here to talk about. The Ralbag reads what's happening in this section in general, and we didn't get to the end of it. The end of it is going to include a lot of his family members, name some of his generals. So Ralbag understands that the goal in this end section of the Perek is to set the stage for the rest of his reign. We're introducing the key players and themes of the rest of his malchus, the rest of his monarchy. He desists from the war. So Radak says that's because the Urim Batumim didn't answer him, or because he took so much time with his trial of Yonatan that they had already run away. It's too late. Right? We're sitting here dithering about what to do with Yonatan. The Plishtim aren't sitting and watching, right, eating honey. The Plishtim are running as fast as they can. So therefore he's done. Now Jeanette, you had asked a question about the Urim Thummim answering him, but right. The Urim Thummim doesn't answer him.
Right. No, but what I was talking about was the Urim Thummim. He then set up this test where he separated the people and he said that the Urim Thummim should respond and say which side was guilty and which side was innocent, whichever way we interpret that.
Yeah.
And it did happen.
Yes.
So is that problematic with Abravanel, or does he feel it's different because at that point Hashem is showing. In other words, you know, if Hashem is angry at him and that's the reason why, and he said, I'm finished with you, I'm not going to answer you, but then he did as soon as he said.
So I would read it, within Abarbanel, I would read it that the Urim Batumim is trying to teach him that he's guilty,
right.
And Shaul and Yonatan miss the point. In Abarbanel's read, Shaul and Yonatan miss the point. They think Eli missing the point also, right, with Kana, which the Gemara in Yuma says, because it isn't enough that you get an answer from the Urim Batumim. You need a certain level of Ruach HaKodesh to explain what the answer was. So we have a second misread of the Urim Batumim as Abarbanel understands what happened. So Shaul decides not to pursue war there. However, he pursues wars against basically everybody else. He strengthens his power this way, right? The pasuk says, where was the language? It was that word again of lachad, right? Veshul lachad hamelucha, right? Just the same word that was used with the Urim Batumim. He captures the monarchy, presumably national support, although Ralbag says, lachad is this word for capturing. He thinks that everybody's intimidated. Like, he's the winning king in all of these battles. We better not cross him.
Hence, he inspired terror.
No, he inspired terror is only under Yarshia, but the question, and that's towards the enemy. Two different ways to take Yarshia. Well, three different ways to take Yarshia, really. But two of them are more literal, and one of them is drash, and we have to talk about why the drash does this. So we still have time. We can do this. Take a look at number 13, please. Ralbag gives you two different approaches. I didn't translate this part of the sheet because I wanted to fit everything on the one page. But Ralbag writes, I'm going to go through it with you, don't worry. Number one, Shechayev oyevav v'yashchitem. Yarshia, from the word rasha, is to find somebody guilty. Yechayev oyevav, he found them chayav. He found his enemies guilty and destroyed them. That's his first explanation. Second, Oya ratzon baze yarshia hayanilcham, or yarshia means he fought them, rotzalomar meaning, shehuayanilcham bechol asher yifne sheyasu lo chamas. He fought against those who started up with him. Yarshia, he identified rishaim. He fought with those he found to be wicked. Vizel Amro Basof, as the pasuk continues to say, Vayatzel as Yisrael miyad shoseyu, he saved Israel from those who raided them. So Bechol Asher Yifnei Yarshia, he fought those who were Rishaim. He fought those who were wicked. So Ralbag either says Yarshia means he destroyed, or it means he fought those who were wicked. And then you get a midrash that says, no. Yarshia is what it sounds like. Yarshia means to act as a rasha, to act in a way that is wicked. Take a look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 14. They read Yarshia as he failed. Bechulu, it's talking about Shaul's jealousy of David. And it mentions traits that David had. And then it says, Bechulu, with all the traits that David had, positive traits, Amarlahu Yonatan bini kamahu. He said, "Yeah, but my son Yonatan is his match." Kaven damar le Hashem imo. But then you get to the point where the text in Shmuel says Hashem was with David, and those who were there at my shir on December 25th, remember I talked a lot about these words, Hashem imo, that God was with him. Milsa dividide nami lo hava be. That's something that even Shaul himself didn't have. Chalash date v'iknia be. Then he got upset and he got jealous. With Shaul it says, everywhere he turned, he ruined things. And with David it says, wherever he turned, he succeeded. Now the truth of the matter is, you do not have such a pasuk. So commentators try to figure out what they're referring to. Either, I think, it's maskil, because you did have with David that everywhere he turned, he was maskil. That's one approach. Another approach might be, there's a pasuk in the first paragraph of Tehillim that describes the righteous person and how he does is matzliach. B'chol asher yaseh yatzliach. So maybe that's the reference. But the point that the Gemara is making is that he fails everywhere he goes. That's what Yarshia is. Or, alternatively, take a look at number 15, the Gemara in Erevin, describing the difference between David and Shaul. David degali mesechta ksiv be yireacha yiruni v'yismachol kiledvarcha yichalti. David revealed tractates, meaning he studied Torah, Talmud, the verbal tradition, and he taught ideas within Torah. And for him, the Pasuk in Tehillim says, those who revered you, God, they will see me, and they will rejoice, because I longed for your word, God, meaning for Torah. Shaul delogali mesechta, Shaul did not do that. And therefore, with everything he did, just the opposite, he ruined things. So Yashia is read as a term for ruining things, instead of the way that Ralbag took it. Yes, Ricky?
Well, that reflects the muddy the water.
Oh, from his vow. I suppose, yes. The Right. But the question that you do have to ask in this is, why does the Medrash do this? Why are we picking on Shaul? Meaning, just read it. This is still his good part.
Yeah.
Right?
He hasn't even come into the story.
Yeah, that is not even here. But why is it that we're attacking Shaul? You know, why does the Medrash feel a need to read Yarshia in this negative way? And I think the answer is, remember what Medrash does. Right? Medrash has an ear for language. Medrash doesn't care about having a nice narrative and story where everything fits together. What Medrash cares about is explaining the choice of words. Choice of words, spelling of words, and so on. And what the Medrash is doing here is it's saying, if you wanted to say that he was successful in his battles, that he intimidated the enemy, there were lots of words you could have used. The fact that Shmuel goes out of his way to say, B'chol asher yifneh yarshia, the Medrash picks up on that and says, you wouldn't have used a word connoting wickedness unless you meant there was something here for us to pick up on. And so that's what the Medrash is doing. Granted, it makes it not fit the context anymore, because the context was a positive one for Shaul, but Yarshia is trying to give me some kind of message here. Not everything is going the way it should go. That's the idea. I just want to make sure that I wrap up the last bit of this, and then I can take a question.
It's hard, but just quick comment.
Even worse. I'll let me just finish this, and then the comment. Don't do that. We gave this list of his battles, right? Including the battle with Amalek, which is coming up in the next chapter.
Right.
So this will answer some of the questions that were asked when we read these psukim, including mentioning the plishtim here. The Radak and Malbim say that striking Amalek is a reference to what's going to happen in the next chapter. Meaning, we're just getting foreshadowing and introduction of the rest
That's
of his reign. Okay, so Radak, Malbim, and Ricky say that striking Amalek is a reference to what's going to happen next, and therefore, within that light, it could be the battle with the Plishtim refers to either the war that just happened, or the wars we know are going to happen at the end of Shmuel Aleph with the Plishtim. Whereas Abarbanel disagrees. And Abarbanel says, no, this is part of, this, what's going to happen in chapter 15 is part of what's described in this sentence. In other words, this is part of what's described as saving the Jews from their raiders. Amalek, we know, was a nomadic tribe that was living in the land east of the Yarden. Granted that Amalek also had a hold in Israel, as seen in the next chapter, when Shaul is going to tell the Keni to move away. Yeah. So we know that they had a hold in Israel, but this is talking about the bands of Amalek who were among those who raided them. And the story in the next chapter is going to be a different story. That's another way to read it. It's certainly easier to take the view of Radak and Malbim that it's a reference to what's going to happen in the next chapter if you take their chronology of Shaul's reign, that all of this has to happen in a very short period of time. He only has a year and change left. He's going to fight all of these wars in that very small period of time. Whereas Abarbanel and Ralbag say, no, he's got years and years to go. So therefore, you can say that this is separate from what we're going to read about in the next story. It could be that that's what determines how you take these wars. It depends on how you understand how long Shaul was king. The less time you have for him to be king, the more you have to sandwich things together. So what we'll do next time, God willing, is number one, the last three psukim that talk about Shaul's wife, Shaul's generals, Shaul's children. We have a couple of questions that we're going to have to deal with in there. And then I want to do a summary at the end of the chapter on Yonatan. and say, what do we now know about Yonatan? What is it that drives him? Because I think we now have, while we haven't seen everything there is to see about him yet, we've seen enough that we are going to have some very interesting things to say about his identity. So God willing, that will be next week as well. And then we move into the war with Amalek. Thank you.